Dinosaurs were so often found on mountain tops. How on earth did they get there? Those who thought they had a solution fell into two opposing camps. One group, known as the Neptunists, was convinced that everything on Earth, including seashells in improbably lofty places, could be explained by rising and falling sea levels. They believed that mountains, hills, and other features were as old as the Earth itself, and were changed only when water sloshed over them during periods of global flooding. Opposing them were the Plutonists, who noted that volcanoes and earthquakes, among other enlivening agents, continually changed the face of the planet, but clearly owed nothing to wayward seas. The Plutonists also raised awkward questions about where all the water went when it wasn't in flood. If there was enough of it at times to cover the Alps, then where, pray, was it during times of tranquility, such as now? Their belief was that the Earth was subject to profound internal forces, as well as surface ones. However, they couldn't convincingly explain how all those clamshells got up there. It was while puzzling over these matters that Hutton had a series of exceptional insights. From looking at his own farmland, he could see that soil was created by the erosion of rocks, and that particles of this soil were continually washed away and carried off by streams and rivers and redeposited elsewhere. He realized that if such a process were carried to its natural conclusion, then Earth would eventually be worn quite smooth. Yet everywhere around him there were hills. Certainly there had to be some additional process, some form of renewal and uplift that created new hills and mountains to keep the cycle going. The marine fossils on mountaintops, he decided, had not been deposited during floods, but had risen along with the mountains themselves. He also deduced that it was heat within the earth that created new rocks and continents and thrust up mountain chains. It is not too much to say that geologists wouldn't grasp the full implications of this thought for 200 years, when finally they adopted plate tectonics. Above all, what Hutton's theories suggested was that Earth processes required huge amounts of time, far more than anyone had ever dreamed. There were enough insights here to transform utterly our understanding of the Earth. In 1785, Hutton worked his ideas up into a long paper which was read at consecutive meetings of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. It attracted almost no notice at all. It's not hard to see why. Here, in part, is how he presented it to his audience. In the one case, the forming cause is in the body, which is separated, for after the body has been actuated by heat, it is by the reaction of the proper matter of the body that the chasm which constitutes the vein is formed. In the other case, again, the cause is extrinsic in relation to the body in which the chasm is formed. There has been the most violent fracture and divulsion, but the cause is still to seek, and it appears not in the vein, for it is not every fracture and dislocation of the solid body of our earth in which minerals or the proper substances of mineral veins are found. Needless to say, almost no one in the audience had the faintest idea what he was talking about. Encouraged by his friends to expand his theory, in the touching hope that he might somehow stumble onto clarity in a more expansive format, Hutton spent the next 10 years preparing his magnum opus, which was published in two volumes in 1795. Together, the two books ran to nearly 1,000 pages and were remarkably worse than even his most pessimistic friends had feared. Apart from anything else, nearly half the completed work now consisted of quotations from French sources, still in the original French. A third volume was so unenticing that it wasn't published until 1899, more than a century after Hutton's death, and the fourth and concluding volume was never published at all. Hutton's Theory of the Earth is a strong candidate for the least read important book in science, or at least would be if there weren't so many others. Even Charles Lyell, the greatest geologist of the following century and a man who read everything, admitted he couldn't get through it. Luckily, Hutton had a Boswell in the form of John Playfair, a professor of mathematics at the University of Edinburgh and a close friend, who could not only write silken prose, but, thanks to many years at Hutton's elbow, actually understood what Hutton was trying to say, most of the time. In 1802, 5 years after Hutton's death, Playfair produced a simplified exposition of the Huttonian principles entitled Illustrations of the Huttonian Theory of the Earth. The book was gratefully received by those who took an active interest in geology, which in 1802 was not a large number. That, however, was about to change. And how? In the winter of 1807, 13 like-minded souls in London got together at the Freemasons' Tavern at Long Acre in Covent Garden to form a dining club to be called the Geological Society. The idea was to meet once a month to swap geological notions over a glass or two of Madeira and a convivial dinner. The price of the meal was set at a deliberately hefty 15 shillings to discourage those whose qualifications were merely cerebral. It soon became apparent, however, that there was a demand for something more properly institutional, with a permanent headquarters, where people could gather to share and discuss new findings. In barely a decade, membership grew to 400, still all gentlemen, of course, and the geological was threatening to eclipse the royal as the premier scientific society in the country. The members met twice a month, from November until June, when virtually all of them went off to spend the summer doing field work. These weren't people with a pecuniary interest in minerals, you understand, or even academics for the most part, but simply gentlemen with the wealth and time to indulge a hobby at a more or less professional level. By 1830, there were 745 of them, and the world would never see the like again. It is hard to imagine now, but geology excited the 19th century, positively gripped it, in a way that no science ever had before or would again. In 1839, when Roderick Murchison published The Silurian System, a plump and ponderous study of a type of rock called greywacke, it was an instant bestseller, racing through four editions, even though it cost 8 guineas a copy and was, in true Huttonian style, unreadable. As even a Murchison supporter conceded, it had a total want of literary attractiveness. And when, in 1841, the great Charles Lyell travelled to America to give a series of lectures in Boston, sell-out audiences of 3,000 at a time packed into the Lowell Institute to hear his tranquilizing descriptions of marine zeolites and seismic perturbations in Campania.